Welcome to another episode of our NCLEX review series. In this podcast, we continue to bring you valuable materials to help you prepare for your exam. Enjoy.
This is the beginning of the pediatric nursing lecture.
We're going to talk about the infancy period. This is the baby from birth to 1 year. Okay, the neonatal period is actually considered the first month of life. Some people call the day of birth to the end of the first month the neonatal period, or the newborn period, and then they call the first month to the end of the first year the infancy period. Don't sweat that too much, okay? It's just a matter of semantics. Basically, what you need to remember about the infant is the issue of trust versus mistrust. This is the trust. Baby is born, right? He cries, somebody picks him up and feeds him. He cries, somebody changes his diaper. He cries, somebody picks him up and talks to him, okay? So through this experience, the child learns that he can trust somebody else, and he develops what we call a trusting relationship, usually with a primary caregiver, like a mother, but it can be a grandmother, it could be a babysitter, it could be a father, whoever that person happens to be. As long as the child's needs are being met, he cries, you pick him up. He cries, you feed him. He cries, you hold him. He cries, you offer him a toy. Okay, so he starts to learn, well, when I cry, somebody's going to come and take care of me, so I must be worth something. Okay, it's actually the very beginning of self-worth. Oh, so I must be important. If I cry, everybody jumps up. Okay, so I must be pretty important. And that's the very, very beginning of the whole concept of self-esteem. And that's what you have to remember. So when you're talking about the infant in the hospital or the infant who's ill, one of the major things that you as the nurse want to continue to maintain and make sure there's no interruption is in a trusting relationship with a primary caregiver. Whichever way you have to answer that question, that's how you'll answer it. We'll talk about it in a couple minutes towards the end of this discussion. Children who do not experience this primary relationship with another human being often will develop what we call failure to thrive. They just don't grow. They, for some reason, they don't gain weight and they don't develop normally. So it's very, very, very important, and we're going to talk about that too. Developmental milestones. Milestones are another way of saying standards, okay? Some children make the standard early. That's fine, okay? But some children don't make the standard on time, and then we worry about them. I'll give you an example that I'm sure you'll all relate to. You might have had to have a 75 to pass your course, right? If you got a 95, was that a problem? No. You really exceeded the minimal requirement for passing, but it certainly was no problem. If anything, it was good, right? But if you got a 73, even though you came very close to meeting the standard, you wouldn't be sitting here today. So that's the point with milestones. If you come very, very close, you're just a hair away, you do not pass the course. Even if you're really close, you're closer to the, if you get a 73, you're actually closer to the passing standard than if you get a 95. But if you get a 73, you haven't met the standard. You haven't made it there. So you fail. And that's the same thing with developmental milestones. And this is what a lot of students get confused with. They pick something that's closest to the milestone. Doesn't matter if the kid is 6 months old and he's jumping and running and riding a tricycle, okay? It matters if he's 6 months old and he has not started rolling over yet, okay? That's what we need to worry about. So let's look at some of the things that we call milestones. Okay, and basically that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to tell you what the milestones are, what the passing criteria is. If you can remember the passing criteria, you will be able to figure out any kind of situation that they give you. Okay, and I'm just giving you a few of the most important ones. All I want you to remember are these few that we're going to talk about. The rest of them, don't sweat it. You'll be able to figure it out. I'll show you as we go along. Birth weight, very important milestone. Okay, when a child is born, like I said, he grows and develops. By 6 months, a child should have doubled his birth weight. That is the minimum passing grade in weight gain. If a child weighs 4 pounds at birth, he should be at least 8 pounds at his 6-month birthday. If a child weighs 10 pounds at birth, he should be hitting pretty close to 20 pounds. Okay, so very important to know the birth weight. If somebody comes and tells me, I have a 6-month-old that weighs 14 pounds, is he normal? Can I answer that? No, I really can't answer that. Because I need to know, well, where did he start from? Okay, I need to know what his particular passing grade would be. Okay, if I find out that he weighed 7 pounds, 8 ounces, and now they come and they tell me, well, he's 14 pounds at 6 months, is he okay? Is he really okay? What's 7.8 and 7.8? 15.6, but I just said he weighs 14 pounds. So did he meet the criteria? No, so he hasn't met the criteria. So don't get thrown off by looking at 7 and 7 is 14. It's not 7 and 7, it's 7.5 pounds, plus 7.5 pounds, okay? So that's how you have to look at it, okay? Make sure, because this is the way they ask you. And they'll tell you the baby weighs 14 pounds and he was 7 pounds 1 ounce at birth. Well, 7 pounds 1 ounce and 7 pounds 1 ounce comes out to 14 pounds 2 ounces. Did he pass? No, he's still under, okay? Even if he's a little bit under, it may not be a serious problem, but he's under. Pick the child that's next to over. So for example, if they say to you, well, which of the following would indicate that the child is growing properly, you would pick the one that's closest to over. Okay, so if they say the child weighs 17 pounds, the child weighs 23 pounds, or the child weighs 37 pounds, pick 17 pounds, because that's the closest to being over. Okay, we want to be on the over side, close to over. Okay, so this is how you do it. Lots of people get that question wrong, because they think double, you just have to double the math. You have to make sure that the doubling fits where it's supposed to. Birth weight triples in a year. They don't always ask you about that. It usually stick to more the 6-month mark. It's usually the 6 months. So, but it does triple in a year. The posterior fontanelle, remember we talked a little bit about fontanelles yesterday? Actually, I didn't talk extensively about the posterior. There's a small, basically it's about the size of a fingertip, little opening in the back, which is the posterior fontanelle. It usually closes 2 to 3 months. 3 months, that's your max. After 3 months, if that's open, is that normal? No. The height, sometimes they ask you, on average, most babies are about 20 inches at birth. Okay, that's kind of the general standard. Most babies come out at about 20 inches. By the end of the first year, normal children will have increased their length by 50%. So all you have to do is take the birth length and multiply it times 1.5. So if the child is 20 inches at birth, 20 inches times 1.5 is what? 30, right? 1.5 times 20 is 30. That's all you have to do. Take that number, multiply times 1.5, and that's your length at the end of the first year. Head circumference and chest circumference are not equal. In the first year of life, the head is actually slightly larger, usually by about 2 centimeters, than the chest. That's why, remember we were talking yesterday about true conjugate and how to measure to make sure that the head is going to come out? The chest we don't worry about, because if the head can get out, the chest is going to get out. Okay, the shoulders can move sideways, and they can change the diameter. So we worry most about the head, because the head is the biggest, widest part of the body. And those are most of your physical milestones that they could possibly ask you. They probably will never ask you any other question about physical milestones. How big, what size, you know, that thing. We're going to look at some of the psychosocial motor skills that we're going to use as milestones. Okay? Between 1 and 3 months, the baby is really just working on the primary relationship and it's really just starting to use its senses, okay? So let's look and see. By the time a child is 3 months old, he should be able to smile when he makes eye contact with somebody. It's what we call a social smile. All 3-month-old babies, if they're developing a good relationship with their primary caregiver, should smile. So 3 months old, we have good smiling, good smiling. So if they say to you, when does smiling begin? Does it begin at 3 months? No, because I just said he's really good at it. So we know it has to begin a little bit before that. When a newborn, when a baby is born, is he smiling? No, we all know babies don't smile. So you have to pick a number somewhere between birth and 3 months for when this milestone would start. If they ask you, when does this start? Okay? And this is how you're going to use these guidelines. All right? You'll know one, and then you'll figure out what comes before and what comes after. Okay. The three-month-old usually responds to stimuli with his whole body. That means if you say, coochie-coo, little baby, he kicks and he moves his arms and his legs and he smiles at you and he makes eye contact. He is not able to really reach out and grab things. He's just able to take his arms and swing them around. Okay? So we know right away we're not going to offer this child any kind of a toy that he has to direct his arm towards and grab onto. Okay? Does this baby still have any kind of reflex, do you think? Yeah, probably minimal reflexes still. Particularly grasp reflex is still probably a minimal reflex. So if you put a rattle in his hand, would he hold it? Okay, but would he be able to use it for anything? Would he be able, if he drops it, would he be able to pick it up? No, so is it a good toy to give to a baby of 3 months old? No, because he really can't do anything with it. It's only staying in his hand because of his reflex. He's not really controlling it. Okay, the three-month-old, and I'll go back to the toys again as we go along, you'll see. He knows his primary caregiver. If he's had a good experience, he recognizes the voice, he recognizes the smell, and most babies will be more easily comforted by their primary caregiver than by a stranger. It doesn't mean that if a stranger comes and holds him, he will be upset. He won't. He'll let you hold him. If you walked in, if a three-month-old baby came in here right now and any one of you picked him up, he would not cry. Okay, at 3 months old, as far as motor skills, a three-month-old can lift their head and chest in a prone position. Okay, when you lay them on their belly, they push up like this. In fact, I always tell students, if you want to imagine what a three-month-old looks like, you ever see the Sears baby photos, the first photos? Most people go and get baby photos, professional baby photos taken of their baby when the baby is around 3 months old, because this is when the baby looks good in the picture. Okay? This is when the baby can lift his head, look at the camera, and smile. Okay? Earlier than this, you're going to get a picture of a baby sort of slumped over like this, just hanging there, may not be looking at the camera, probably not smiling, and you're going to send that out on your Christmas cards, and people are going to say, oh my God, did you ever see an uglier kid? Okay? So what most people do is wait till this period where the baby is really able to respond to the camera. And that's the three-month-old. So if you want to think of what they look like, picture that. Picture that baby propped up on his belly, lifting his head, looking at the camera with a big smile. Okay? The three-month-old can follow objects with his eyes. So if you have a toy in a crib, he'll look at it. If you move the toy, he'll follow it. He'll turn his head to follow and watch it. Okay, so what kind of toys are the best, safest, and most stimulating toys for this age group? Anything that stimulates their visual or auditory senses. Okay, visual and auditory. They can't do anything with their hands. They cannot take a toy and pick it up and play with it. So you want to give them things that are going to stimulate them visually, things they can look at, like a mobile. Does everybody know what a mobile is? Okay, because they use, yeah, a mobile is a toy that hangs over the crib, and it usually has little things, toys, pictures, and it usually also sometimes has a music box attached to it. You turn it, and it spins around, and the child hears music and sees the toy moving around, so the child is able to watch the toy. Okay, that is stimulating to a three-month-old or younger child. A music box, a mirror, placing a mirror along a safe mirror, because they make special mirrors to put in cribs. A mirror is a good stimulating object for a three-month-old because they can look at their face in the mirror and they can see themselves moving. But nothing that they really have to actively stimulate because they really can't do it. There's a commercial on TV. I don't know if you've seen this new toy. I think it's made by Fisher-Price. It's like a piano key, but it's put up along the edge of the foot of the crib. And when the baby kicks, his feet randomly hit this thing and it makes music. But if you don't place the child close enough to it, where when he kicks, he's going to hit it, he has no control over making that toy make any kind of a noise. So I thought it was a kind of interesting toy for, you know, this age group. Can he see this toy? No, child can't see the toy. He's laying on his back, okay? And the toy is at the edge of the crib. So it's just interesting to see how they make certain toys. But anyway, so that's probably not the greatest toy for a baby 3 months old, because he really can't do anything with it unless you help him. This is not something the child can stimulate himself with. Okay, so now you all know, it's pretty clear, right? And if you have to buy a baby gift for somebody, now you know what to buy. If you're going to a baby shower sometime in the next couple of weeks, you know what to buy. Okay, by the time our baby hits 6 months, okay, he's doubled his age, right? He's doubled his birth weight, like we said earlier. And he now has really established a pretty significant relationship with his primary caregiver, his mother, whatever. And so now when he sees somebody he doesn't know, he looks at you like he doesn't know you. Because now he knows who he knows and who he doesn't know. So when you walk into the room of a six-month-old and he's never seen you before, he will probably give you a little bit of an apprehensive look. Like, I don't think I saw you before. That tells you that this child has developed a good relationship with a primary caregiver. Some children are more relaxed and easygoing and have more relaxed temperaments than others. So some children, it's not as obvious, but all children who develop good relationships with primary caregivers will recognize when they don't know somebody by 6 months old. Will they cry? Probably not, but they'll look at you funny. A six-month-old starts to babble and coo. Okay? Those are pre-speech sounds. Six-month-olds should be making babbling and cooing sounds. Babbling and cooing sounds are sounds like eh, ooh, eh, bleh, eh. That's a babbling and cooing sound. Okay? They just vocalize and they hear their own voice, and that stimulates them to continue to vocalize. Children who don't hear, who can't hear, don't vocalize usually. And that's usually one indication. Children who don't make sounds, oftentimes people think that there's something wrong with their throat. No, it's oftentimes there's something wrong with their hearing. A six-month-old observes their environment. Now they're looking at everything. Now they not only are looking at what's in their crib, but they're looking, they're stretching their head around to see what's around the corner. Okay? They're very interested in looking at things. A six-month-old, in their motor skills, is able to roll from side to side very well, rolling over, belly to back, back to belly, okay? He's got this down pat now. He knows how to do this. So if they say to you, when does rolling begin? When would you expect the rolling to start? What kind of an answer would you pick? Did it start at 6 months? No. Was he rolling at all at three? Did I say he was rolling at three? No. So when did if they say, when does rolling begin? When would be normal to see the baby begin to roll? What would you pick? Four or five? Something like that. Okay? You see, that's how you're going to use this information. Because if you tried to learn 1 month this, 2 months that, 3 months, you'd all be ripping your hair out and you'd never learn any of the MedSurg stuff. Okay, so we're going to do this as a shortcut, and it works really, really, really good. It really works. So, if he's doing something really good, when I tell you he's doing it really good, he had to have learned it before. Okay? At 6 months, the baby now can sit with some assistance. Okay? That means if you hold him or he's got back support, he's able to stay in a sitting position holding his head up. Younger than this, if you put a child in a sitting position, he's going to start to slide off to the side. His head is going to start to roll after a while. Okay? So if they asked you, what piece of equipment would you encourage the parents to purchase for the six-month-old, what piece of equipment do you think would suit a six-month-old fairly well? A crib? When should they buy a crib? When they bring the baby home, the baby should have a place to sleep, a safe place to sleep. Okay, so What about a carriage or some sort of a walker? Or how about a walker? Do you think a walker is appropriate at this age? No. So, right, this young man in the front said a high chair. Okay? A high chair is the perfect piece of equipment because now he can sit in the high chair and he's going to start, we're going to talk about dietary requirements in a few minutes, but he's also going to start to include different foods in his diet. So a high chair, because he now can sit, and the high chair offers the right amount of support for their back so they can stay in a sitting position. You put a younger baby than that in a high chair, he's going to slide right out. Okay. A six-month-old also can transfer objects from hand to hand. He can now use a palm or grasp. Okay, he deliberately, remember we said reflexes at 3 months? Remember we said 6 months, no more reflexes? He now voluntarily will take his hand, grasp an object that's within his reach, and if he wants, he can move it to his other hand, and he will be able to put it in his palm and hold on to it for as long as he wants to. Now it's voluntary. He also has the gross motor skill of what we call eye-hand coordination, and able to move his hand where he wants it to go and get hold of that thing. Usually if you're holding a six-month-old, what do they do when you're holding them? You're holding them upright in your arms, and what are they doing to you? They're pulling your earrings. They're grabbing at your glasses if you wear glasses. They're pulling at your necklace, right? Do they have any trouble getting their hand right on your glasses? None whatsoever. Okay? And they grab right hold of it, right in the right spot, right to twist them and break them. They know what they're doing. So this is transferring and using eye-hand coordination with a palm or grasp. So, now would you give this baby a rattle to play with? Absolutely, because now he can pick it up, and he can shake it around, and he can put it in his other hand if he wants to, and he can bang things with it if he really wants to. Okay, so now you can offer the child any kind of a toy that he has to then go pick up with his own hand and hold on to. Okay, we want to make sure that all the toys that are offered to this age group are toys that are able to be put where? Where else is, what else do you think the child's going to do once he gets something in his hand? Mouth, right. So all toys offered to this age group have to be soft and able to be cleaned so that they can go in the mouth. Okay, we don't want to offer metal toys. We particularly don't want to really offer any wooden toys because wood sometimes splinters. Okay, we want plastic. We want something that's soft that can be licked, basically. Bright colors, because we still want to stimulate visual and we still want to stimulate auditory. Okay, but now you can add to the mix things that the child has to manipulate. Would you give the child a puzzle? No, because what would he do with a puzzle? Yeah, he'll probably take out the pieces and try to put them in his mouth. He would never ever try to put them back in the puzzle. Okay, so that's totally out of the question for a young baby. You want to give them large blocks. You want to give them rattles. You want to give them stuffed toys, anything that they can pick up and soft. Okay. By the time the baby hits 9 months, he has learned some imitative behaviors. Now, most nine-month-olds can do tricks. Wave bye-bye. Wave bye-bye. And what do? Nothing. And then as soon as you walk away, they're going like this. Okay. They can clap hands. Whatever they've been taught repetitively, if you teach them clap hands, or how big is the baby, and they put your arms up in the air, they'll do that. They start to imitate. They begin imitating. That's the beginning of imitating. As far as the pre-speech sounds, they have gotten more sophisticated. And most children, all children really, regardless of the language that they're being spoken to in, will say, mama, dada, mama, dada, goo, goo, gaga, papa, dada. They all say that. They're not calling you. They're not realizing that you are their mother. What happens is, all babies in the whole world make these same sounds. So what the parents do, they say, oh my God, my child is a genius. He knows how to say mama. So they start to say, mama's coming. Mama's going to be right there. Give the toy to your dada. And then the child starts to realize, oh, if I say mama, I get rewarded. So the child will get up and say, Mama, Mama, and the mother comes running in. I've actually heard people have arguments over the child says Mama first or the child said Dada first. They all say it. I don't care what language you speak. Most of you, many of you here, speak other languages. I don't think there's anybody in this room who would defy what I'm saying. In your language, there is some variation of this mama, dada, repetitive vocalization that means mother and father. Right? Papa, yaya, gaga. I don't, you take your pick. Okay? These are pre-speech sounds. And everybody thinks that the child is a genius. It's really funny. I've literally heard people on the subway, like I once was sitting on the subway with a mother and a daughter, a grown daughter and a mother, and they were having this whole discussion of how she was such a brilliant child, and she said mama when she was 9 months old, and how her father was so disappointed that she said mama before she said dada. And they went on and on and on about this discussion of when her first words were. Okay, so not to burst anybody's bubble, but keep this in mind. 9 month olds also now really know who they know and who they don't know. And they don't like the people that they don't know because they don't trust you. Because now they know what trust feels like. So if they see somebody that they don't know, they don't trust you. So if you go to take a 9 month old away from his mother, what do you think he's going to do? Cry, right? A normal 9 month old will cry when he's being held by a stranger. So it's very important as the nurse to remember, once you get a baby at around this age, if you need to do any kind of physical exam or procedure, the best place to do it is with the child sitting on the mother's lap. Because if you remove that child from the mother, he's going to start to cry and be very, very upset. So this child really does better closest to his parent. Children who do not develop stranger anxiety at all usually is an indication that they may not have developed a trusting relationship because they don't care who they're with. So if the baby happily goes off with you and doesn't really give even a look back to his mother, that's sometimes a little bit worrisome. We want the child to cry when he's taken from his mother. That's a good sign. Like I said, some children are more easygoing than others, and some children have had more experiences with lots of people, and they're more relaxed about it. But if given the choice in a stressful situation, and you take a 9-month-old, and you give him the choice between his mother and a stranger, he will always choose his mother. They also now understand something called object permanency. Earlier than this, if you hide something or you remove something from their vision, they think it's gone, that's it, all gone, no more, it's not coming back. But now they understand that if you take something away from them and you hide it behind your back, they will start to look for it. This also has to do with the fact that they know that when you walk out of the room, you're going to come back. Okay? They know that things don't just disappear. If you take something and hide it under a blanket, a 9-month-old will go and look for it if he saw it. At 9 months, the child who was sitting with assistance now sits independently. If you sit him down on the floor, he'll stay in a sitting position. So independent sitting occurs somewhere between 6 and 9 months. He now, instead of the Palmer grasp, at 9 months, he's gotten much more sophisticated. He can use what we call a pincer grasp with two little fingers. And believe me, with these two little fingers, he can cause a lot of havoc. 9-month-olds can crawl. If you put them on the floor, they can get up on all fours and start to crawl around. And between the pincer grasp and the crawling, they pull things out of your carpet or out from under your couch that you never even knew existed. They pull out pieces of earrings that were long lost. They pull crumbs from Christmas dinner 3 years ago. I mean, things that you never imagined were in your house are now being brought to your attention constantly. And if you're not quick enough, you might never see them because they'll go right from there straight into their mouth. The 9-month-old now stands with some assistance, which means that if he pulls himself to a standing position, he can hold on and stay standing. They usually do this at 3 o'clock in the morning. They stand up in their crib, and they grab onto the side rail of the crib, and then they start to yell for help because they can't get back down. So you, as the parent, half asleep, you go in the child's room, and you remove him from... He's hanging on, he's got like white knuckles from holding on so tight, and you pry his little hands off the edge of the crib, you lay him back down. 5 minutes later, he's standing up at the edge of the crib again, holding on for dear life. And they'll do this over and over and over, but they can't get down. They can't reverse the process. And this goes on for several months. Okay, so what do we want to give this child? Once again, we can stick with most of the toys that we've used earlier. The rattle, the soft toy, things that they can put, they like to put things in containers and take things out of containers. So large containers where you can put blocks in. They just like to do those kind of processes, put things in and take things out. Make sure all the toys are easy to clean, safe, can be put in the mouth, nothing smaller than the size of a child's fist, no small pieces, nothing that has little parts that come off, because with the pincer grasp, they can pull things off, and they're really good at it. By the first birthday, the child is now imitating behaviors very well. He does all the tricks, say bye-bye, clap hands. He cooperates with dressing. If you put a shirt on his head, he'll literally lift his arm to put his arm in the sleeve. He'll lift it for you. You do not have to no longer pull his arm up. A one-year-old will start to go like this, and all you have to do is get the sleeve over his hands, and he'll push his arm right through it. They now understand that mama and dada has meaning, because we taught them that. So now when they're calling mama, 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 they want you to come in the room. And they also can show some sign of jealousy at this point. They actually know, you're my mother, you're not his mother, and you better stick with me. If they see you holding another baby, they will come over and start pulling on your leg. They can now walk with assistance. Walking with assistance means that they hold on to the side of something and they can walk around it. And they will opt to walk with assistance over crawling now whenever they can. So if they're trying to reach a toy that's on the other side of the room, but it would be very quick for them to crawl to it and to walk holding on, they have to literally take a detour going all the way around. They'll take that detour going all the way around so that they continue holding on, as opposed to crawling, because now they like this. It's independence. Do they have to walk independently at 12 months? No. That's not the milestone. This is what a lot of people get confused about. What's the milestone for walking? Anybody know? 15 months. 15. It's on the next page anyway, so. 15 months is the milestone for walking. 12 months is not. Lots of people get confused here. Do a lot of 12-month-old babies walk independently? Yeah, lots of them do. I've even seen 9-month-olds that can walk independently. Is that a problem? No. If I have a 14-month-old who's not walking yet, is that a problem? No. Okay? We wait till 15 months before we consider that any kind of a problem. They can turn pages in a book. They can stand now without assistance. And they can attempt to stack blocks. Stacking blocks is eye-hand coordination, once again. It's taking their hand, using their eye, and directing the hand specific to a very specific spot. So now you can give them toys that they can stack. They like toys that they can fit into things, okay, putting things in and taking things out. They also like toys. Here it says push and pull. They're really not ready for pull toys. It's more push toys. They like to stand holding onto a toy that assists them in walking, okay? It's really a push toy. They want to hold onto something that they can walk with. And there's lots of toys like that on the market. You've seen them probably, right? Little walking things that have little... What's usually attached to those walking toys? Usually some sort of large blocks and things that can be fit into large block pieces. Or things that can be pushed with a finger, right? There's lots of activities that require pincer or pointing. Because this child is able to use their pointing finger to touch things. So that's the kind of toys that they look for, things where their finger can be used I think that that probably gives you all you need to know about the infant and how to decide what kind of toys and what they can do. Let's talk very briefly about the issue of hospitalization and the problem with separation. Okay, the big issue here is separation. The child is in the hospital for whatever reason. He's now separated from his primary caregivers, and the issue of trust may be problematic. So in order to prevent developmental delay or regression, you as the nurse want to encourage trust. What's the best way to do it? Have the parent physically around as much as possible. Encourage the parent to participate in caring for the child wherever possible. If the parent says, "Can I bathe my child?" If there are no medical restrictions, what would you tell the parent? Yes. Allow the parent to participate wherever possible. What's the reason you're allowing the parent to participate? Is it so that you can go have your lunch a little early? Is it so the parent won't feel so guilty about their baby being in the hospital? No. It's so the baby will continue trusting the parent. It's not about the parent. It's about the baby. Lots of people answer this question to help the parent. You're not helping the parent. Your job is to help the child. You're using the parent to help the child. Okay, so you want to pick the answer that says that the reason you encourage the parent to participate in the child's care is to assist in maintaining developmental milestones. You see how it's worded? Assist in maintaining developmental milestones. What's the developmental milestone you're trying to attain? Trust. Right. Trust is a milestone. Right. See, sometimes they don't word it so obviously. They don't say trust because that's like, you know, that's totally giving it away. But they expect you to know what the developmental milestone or the significant developmental relationship here for this age group is. They don't tell you trust. They usually don't use the word. They just know, they expect you to know that. Primary nursing is also good if they ask you, where would you place this infant? On the floor. Place this infant as close to the nurse's station as possible. Placing this infant in a room with other infants, would that make him feel better? No. Placing this infant in a room with 4 or 5-year-olds, would that make him feel better? No. This infant needs to be as close to somebody who's going to hold him and feed him as possible. Okay, which in this case is going to be nursing if the parents aren't around. Would this infant benefit by having a volunteer grandmother? You know, sometimes they have those services where they have volunteers that come and spend time with the children. Yes, this is a patient who would benefit by having a volunteer grandmother or one of those kind of services. Make sure that the child is held for all feedings. We don't prop any bottles. Okay, no bottle propping. 2 reasons. One, bottle propping can cause what? Choking, aspiration. And what's the other reason? Feeding is a time for communication and trust. If I'm holding you when I'm feeding you, that means that I'm learning to trust. The baby's learning to trust. So that's how you're going to use this information, okay? And it should work fine. You will not get any of those questions wrong. Okay, on the next page, we talk a little bit about immunizations. They do ask some questions. They usually ask the same question over and over and over again. I would not go crazy trying to memorize the entire immunization schedule. It's not worth memorizing the whole thing. Basically, what you need to know is that most immunizations, if they ask you about any, if they just give you a list of immunizations, pretty much they're all given at 2, 4, and 6 months, with the exception of MMR, which is on the list there. You see mumps, measles, rubella, MMR. Mumps, measles, and rubella is given, in New York State we give it at 12 months, but national standard is 15 months. So pick 15 months, circle that one, because I have it marked as both. It should be given. National standard is 15 months. They would never give you the choice of 12 or 15. And that's the only one that's really a little bit different. So if they give you the whole other list, even if you're not sure what they are, just pick 2, 4, 6 months. They're not going to ask you about varicella vaccine. because they probably don't even know that we're giving that yet. What they might occasionally comes up is contraindications. I'm going to give you the basic contraindications. The only one they usually ask about is MMR, mumps, measles, rubella. They always, if they ask you about any in particular, it's usually the MMR vaccine. That seems to be the only one that they know. Okay, so OPV, which is oral polio, which to tell you the truth isn't even really given anymore. In the last year we've stopped giving it, but other boards, I guarantee you they don't know that. Okay, because don't forget, I told you this test is several years old. So they will ask you about oral polio. Oral polio is made of live poliovirus. If you take a dose of this, what happens is you're getting a tiny little dose of polio, a tiny little exposure. Normal, if you have a normal, healthy immune system, your body will start to make antibodies right away, and the dose of polio is so low, your antibodies will get rid of it, and you will have now developed antibodies, and if you're ever exposed to polio again, your body will has antibodies, so you won't ever catch polio. But if you don't have a functional immune system, polio, a small dose of polio is going to do what? You're going to get polio. So anybody who is immunosuppressed, or any child, if the child lives with a caregiver who's immunosuppressed, because this virus is shed in the stool. So if you're changing the diapers of a baby who's been given oral polio vaccine, he is actually spreading polio virus to whoever's changing his diapers. So if the person changing the diapers is immunosuppressed, they also, the child will not get this particular vaccine. So basically, it's if the child's immunosuppressed or the caregiver is immunosuppressed, no polio vaccine. We have another type of polio vaccine that we do give. They won't ask you about it, so don't even bother. Don't even write it down. They will not ask you. DTP, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. They hardly ever ask about this either, very rarely. This is the one that a lot of parents are very skeptical about giving because there's been some problems with the pertussis. They probably won't go into too much detail on the boards about that. The things you need to be concerned about with the DTP, fever higher than 105. After, there's no contraindication to giving the first shot. Everybody is eligible to get the first vaccine. You only don't get the subsequent vaccines if the child A has a fever higher than 105 after getting the first one. Cries unconsolably. Do you all know what unconsolable crying is? When you baby's crying and no matter what you do, you pick him up, you hold him, you shake him, you rock him, you feed him, nothing you do makes him feel better. Okay, if the child is unconsolably crying for longer than 3 straight hours or has a high-pitched cry, high-pitched crying is an indication of neurological impairment. Or a child who has a seizure following the administration of the vaccine. Children with seizure disorders, do they get the vaccine? Yes. Seizure disorder is not a contraindication. Only if you get a seizure after receiving the shot. Like I said, they usually don't ask about it. Haemophilus influenza, B conjugate, the next one on the list, forget it. They're not going to ask you about it. Mumps, measles, and rubella, they will ask you. This is their favorite. They always ask something about this. Okay? They usually ask, this is contraindicated in a patient who is allergic to eggs. Allergy to eggs, you do not give this vaccine. This vaccine also cannot be given to pregnant women, nor can this vaccine be given to a child less than 1 year old. You have to have hit your first birthday before you can receive this vaccine. It has to do with your immune development. Okay? So, allergy to eggs, pregnant women, and children less than 1 year old cannot receive this vaccine. Hepatitis B, there's no contraindication. They're not going to ask you about it. Varicella, they're not going to ask you about, but it's also made of live virus, and it's an immunosuppression. Children who are immunosuppressed do not get varicella. Varicella, everybody knows, is chickenpox, right? That's the new chickenpox shot. They won't ask you about it. Okay, let's look a little bit at feeding and nutrition. And food introduction. Basically, what you need to know They might ask you, when do you introduce this food? At what age should you introduce that food? Here's the basic guidelines for feeding. All babies should drink breast milk or iron-fortified formula for the first year of life. Babies are born, they're actually born iron-rich, calcium-poor. When they're born, they still have a lot of iron stored that they got from their mother. But within the first 3 months of life, they use it up. And then you have to replace it with nutrition. So one of the ways we do it is iron-fortified formula. Another way that they are replaced for their iron, they start to eat solid foods that contain iron, particularly some of the, they start with the grains. The grains are the cereals, okay, we call them single grain. You can give rice cereal, barley cereal, oatmeal cereal, one cereal at a time. We start them with cereal by 4 months of age, no earlier, because earlier than that they can't digest it. They don't produce adequate enzymes to break down the carbohydrates in the cereal. So if you're giving a three-week-old baby cereal, you're wasting your time. You're actually, he's not digesting it. It goes in one side and comes out the other. It has no nutritional value to a baby younger than 3 or 4 months old. They can't digest it. It just clogs them up. It makes them feel full. What happens is then they feel full and they don't drink enough milk and they're not really getting adequately nourished. So it's much more important to give milk than cereal. Cereal's 3 months, four to six months. At 6 months, we introduce fruits and vegetables. And at 9 months, we introduce protein and fat, which is meats and eggs. That has to do with the pancreas. The pancreas does not produce lipase, which breaks down fats, until about 9 months. So if you give a baby younger than that, high-fat foods, once again, you're going to be cleaning up a lot of diarrhea. Okay, all solid food should be fed with a spoon. Babies have another reflex that I didn't mention yesterday called extrusion, where they stick their tongues out, and anything that touches their tongue makes them thrust their tongue forward. They stick it out. So if you take a spoon to a four-month-old's mouth and you put it to his tongue, the first thing he's going to do is stick his tongue out. And the food is going to be on his tongue, and he's going to keep pushing it out because that's the reflex. Many, extrusion it's called. Many people think, oh, he doesn't like the food. Believe me, their taste buds are not that refined. They'll eat anything. Did you ever taste the milk that they drink? If they'll drink that, believe me, they'll eat anything. So the fact that they stick their tongue out, if the mother says, I don't think my baby likes the cereal, he keeps sticking out his tongue, what would you advise the mother, what would you instruct the mother to do? Keep trying. Keep feeding the child with the spoon. Okay? When will the reflex go away? Completely? When does most reflexes? About 6 months, that reflex is gone anyway. Okay. All foods should be introduced at 4-day intervals. Monday, you're introducing peaches. Then you're going to wait till Friday to introduce peas. Okay? Because if I give peaches on Monday and peas on Tuesday and Wednesday my baby has a rash, I don't know if he's allergic to one of those things. So it's a 4-day interval for introductions of new food. The most common type of allergic reaction in infants is usually skin rashes, particularly like eczema. They don't have anaphylactic reactions to food. Very unusual and unlikely for a baby to have an anaphylactic reaction to food. They usually get a rash. We don't dilute formulas. They have to be mixed the way the manufacturer says, the company, whatever they say. And that's basically mostly all you need to know about the infancy period. They tend to ask some questions about infants. They ask, like I said, usually about the mumps, measles, rubella vaccine. They often ask you about what toy do you put in the crib for an infant. You should be fine. I don't think there's any question that they could ask you that you wouldn't be able to answer. Let's look briefly at the toddler. The toddler is your 1 to 3-year-old. This is the child who's in the stage of autonomy versus shame and doubt. What does that mean? It means he feels real comfortable in his environment. He trusts his primary caregiver. He now wants to go out and explore the world around him. And he wants to become more independent. When he's not successful at independence or exploring,
He feels shameful and doubtful about his abilities. He starts to understand that you have to tolerate some frustration in life. And one of the major milestones is toilet training. The thing about toilet training, I just want to briefly. Toilet training has a lot to do with physiological development as well as psychosocial development. In order to be toilet trained, you have to have sphincter control. It's on the list there under physiological. Sphincter control does not occur until about age 2. Sphincter control has to do with neurological maturity and development of myelin. They're not going to ask you about myelin, so don't worry about it. I just want you to understand it. When a child is younger than 2, some children younger than 2 may understand the concept, pee-pee, toilet, but physiologically, they do not have sphincter control because that part of their body hasn't matured yet. Yeah, they may hit or miss. You might sit them on the toilet and they might pee because you just happened to get them when they had to go. But they will not be able to do it consistently until after age 2. So lots of parents, because they have a child who can say pee-pee and point to the toilet, think that when a child wets his pants, he's doing it on purpose, and he's not. So it's very important if a parent asks you, when do I begin toilet training? You have to acknowledge the child has several signs of readiness. The child has to understand what to do, and the child has to demonstrate physical ability. The child has to be able to keep his diaper dry for at least 4 straight hours without being dehydrated, obviously. He has to be able to literally have some kind of control. Okay, and that's when we talk about toilet training. It's interesting because toilet training is one of the number one causes of child abuse because parents don't understand this and they think that when a 2 or a 2.5-year-old is wetting his pants, he's doing it on purpose. And he's not. He has no choice. He can't feel it. You'll see as we go on in this discussion how that all makes sense when I start to talk about masturbation. Okay, so anyway, our toddler, he quadruples his birth weight. They won't ask you that. Anterior fontanelle, everybody knows that one. That's the 18-month milestone. They usually have a big pot-bellied appearance, and they have an equal head and chest circumference by 1 year of age. By 1 year of age, the head and the chest have equaled out. During the toddler period, it goes the other direction. The chest starts to expand, and the head doesn't grow as rapidly. Actually, the brain grows to 2/3 of its adult size in the first 2 years of life. So that's why the head is so big, because the brain is just growing like crazy. And if you look and see what a child is doing, you realize that there really must be a lot of brain growth, because when the child is born, it does basically nothing. And by the time it's 2, it's walking. It's talking, it's climbing, you know, so there's been a lot of neurological development in those 2 years. Okay, so that's what you got physically. They won't ask you too many physical questions about this kid except about sphincters. They might ask about sphincters. They won't ask about size. 15-month-olds usually have about 4 words in their vocabulary. Most of those words have to do with things that are important to them. My bottle. My blanket. My mommy. Okay? Most of their words have to do with possession. They know one of their body parts. Where's your nose? They can point to it. They can walk. This is the walking without assistance. You can highlight that because that's a milestone that they ask about. And basically, they can build a tower that has about a 2-block height. So now you're getting better eye-hand coordination. They can add blocks to the tower. Best toys, push and pull toys. They love to drag things around behind them. They'll literally, if you tie a rock to a string and you give it to a 15-month-old, he'll walk around dragging that behind him for an hour and a half. That's an activity that they love to do. I guess it probably has a sense of control for them. They are controlling this rock that's being dragged behind them. By 2 years, by the second birthday, they understand possession. They really understand it. They grab stuff away and say, it's mine, mine. They also demonstrate something called negativistic behavior. You say, Johnny, would you like a cookie? And what does Johnny say? No. And if you offer Johnny a cookie, what does he do? Grabs it right out of your hand. So negativistic behavior has to do with control. I can say no.
I can tell you that I'm not going to do what you say, even though I will do it. By two, they also have now developed an attachment to something called a transitional object. A transitional object is something that reminds the child of life when it was secure and comforting. Because now this child is out in the world and he's climbing under the sink and he's putting toilet paper down the toilet bowl and he's trying to open up the front door lock and he's very, very busy all day long. So sometimes he just needs something that reminds him of the good old days. And that thing is usually a blanket, a favorite toy, some kind of a thing that's from his earlier childhood. This is called a transitional object. And just to demonstrate to you how important this particular thing is, when people travel, you can ask anybody in any airport who's traveling with a toddler, does your child have a favorite blanket or toy? They'll tell you yes. If you ask them where that thing is packed, what will they tell you? It's in their carry-on luggage. Guaranteed. No parent would ever put the transitional object in the luggage that goes into the airplane cargo. Because what if they lose your luggage? Your vacation is ruined. They may replace all your clothes, but if they cannot replace this transitional object, you will get no sleep on your vacation. Particularly on a vacation, this is an important thing to bring, because now the child is going to a new place that he's not used to, and so he really needs this transitional object even more. So for example, when a toddler comes into the hospital, what would be something you would ask the parent? Does your child have a favorite blanket or toy? Could you bring it here? Okay. Many times the parent says, yes, I'll bring it. And so the parent comes in with this blanket in a plastic bag, take it out of the plastic bag, it's got chocolate milk stains on it, it's got something crusty on the edge, it's ripped in about three places. So the nursing staff says, ugh, this thing is so disgusting, it stinks, it's filthy, I think we're going to wash it. Okay, so they send it to the laundry and it comes back nice and clean. And what happens when you offer it to the child? He doesn't want it. Right. So the whole point of the transitional object is it has to be exactly in the condition it was when the child last had it. Do not alter it. Don't clean it. Don't wash it. Don't sew it. Don't buy the child a brand new one that looks exactly the same. He won't want it. He wants it exactly the way he's had it. Crusty, stinky. That's how they like it. Okay? They'll even tell you, I like the way my blanket smells. They will. It could even have urine on it. And they'll tell you they like the way it smells. Okay? And it's very important that it is offered to the child in the exact condition that it's in. Don't fix it. Separation anxiety now has actually become full-blown. The child may want to run around away from the parent, but he doesn't want the parent too far from his eyesight. He wants to be able to see his mother while he's taking out all the pots from underneath the kitchen sink. He wants to know that she's somewhere nearby. Okay? So separation anxiety, and it goes both ways. It's very interesting because parents try to blame it on the children, but the parent also is guilty of separation anxiety. Many parents, once their child starts to become a little independent, they suddenly feel like, oh my God, my Johnny doesn't need me anymore. I used to run a daycare center before I was a nurse, and we had toddlers. And this was a typical scenario. The mother would bring the two or two and a half year old in, and she'd say, okay, bye, Johnny. Mommy's going to work now. And Johnny would say, bye, Mommy. See you later. And the mother would say, well, don't you want to give Mommy a kiss? Come over and give Mommy a kiss before I leave. The kid would come over and kiss the mother, go back to playing. The mother would say, now, Johnny, Mommy won't be back until after work. And this would go on and on until the kid was crying, begging the mother not to leave. And then the mother would leave. And then the mother would call later in the day and she'd say, well, how's Johnny doing? And I swear, if you would say, oh, he's wonderful, he's having a great time, he's, you know, getting along fine with all the kids, and you would hear this little disappointment in their voice, like, he's okay? Are you sure? You know, when he goes to take his nap, he might start to cry. You know, they want this because it makes them feel needed too. So this separation anxiety thing goes both ways. It's not really all about the kid. But many parents try to pin it on the child. Oh, yeah, my Johnny can't live without me. Anyway, in order to alleviate separation anxiety for a child who's hospitalized, we really want the child to be with the parent as much as possible because the whole thing is so stressful. If the parent can't be there, get that transitional object because that actually is comforting to a child. And I'm going to talk about it in a little more detail in a couple of minutes. Parallel play. Everybody knows what parallel play is. You remember that from nursing school? If I had two toddlers in this room, they'd be playing physically near each other, but they would not really be interacting. They like to be near each other. They don't like to play together. They're parallel. Something else that's interesting that occurs during this period is temper tantrums. Some of you who are parents may have experienced this. What happens with temper tantrums, most people don't understand this, and then they don't handle it correctly. Temper tantrums start out by, you have a little 18-month-old or 2-year-old who is so busy conquering the world, that's very exhausting and stressful. And sometimes he just gets to the point where he really just can't handle one more thing. We also feel that way many times, but because we've been socialized to know that you can't just lay down on the floor in the supermarket and kick your feet and start to scream, we try to behave ourselves. But a 2-year-old does not know that that is not socially acceptable behavior. So if he's just had it, and you happen to be in the supermarket, he will throw himself on the floor and kick and scream because he is not embarrassed about his behavior. So he's not doing it to embarrass you. He's not doing it to control or manipulate the parent. He's doing this, it's all about him. Believe me, they don't think about you at all. They only think about themselves. They're very egotistical still. Everything that happens is about them. When they wake you up in the middle of the night because they're hungry or thirsty, are they worried that you might have to take the boards tomorrow? No, I guarantee you they could care less. Everything is about them. So if they throw themselves on the floor in the supermarket kicking and screaming, it's about them. It's not to embarrass you. It has nothing to do with you. But what happens is the parent says, oh my God, what am I going to do? People are going to think that I'm not a good parent. People are going to, I can't handle this. So what do? Johnny, please, get up. Here, you want a bag of potato chips? Here's a bag of potato chips. And what does Johnny say? Oh, I didn't know I was getting a reward. I didn't know that there was a prize at the end of this. And so then Johnny starts to understand. Last time I was in the supermarket and I threw myself on the floor crying, I got potato chips. Maybe if I do it today, I'll get a lollipop. And what do you think would happen? He probably will get a lollipop. And he'll start asking for a lollipop. I want a lollipop. I want a lollipop. And then the mother says, oh my God, last time I remember what happened and people were staring at me. I better just give them the lollipop. And so then the child learns, oh, I can use this when I need it. But it doesn't start out that way at all. So when a parent comes to you and says, my child's having temper tantrums. I don't know what to do. What do you advise? The nurse advises the parent to ignore the behavior as much as it kills you. And stay close by the child without making any eye contact. Give the child no contact from you. And the child will stop crying. And all of a sudden, they get up, they brush themselves off, and they're normal. Like nothing ever happened. Because they're crying and screaming because they just feel so overwhelmed. You know when you feel so overwhelmed? Sometimes what we do, you'll go and have a fight with a clerk in a grocery store who you don't even know, who didn't even really do anything because you had a bad day, you know? It's the same kind of thing. And then you feel better. You say, oh, got that off my chest. And then you come out of the grocery store and you're fine. It's the same kind of thing. But little children don't know how to use that, so they just do it whenever they feel like it. So the best thing to do and the best thing to tell parents and advise parents is ignore the behavior. Stick by the child so he doesn't hurt himself. If the mother says, well, he starts banging himself into the wall, what would you tell the mother to do? Would you say to ignore the child who's banging himself into a wall? No. Then you have to intervene. Okay? Then you have to do something. But if the child is not doing any physical harm, let him kick and scream all he wants. Don't even yell at him and say, you know what? If you don't stop that, I'll really give you something to cry about. Because that also is positive reinforcement.
they're getting attention for the behavior. So if you stop giving them attention for the behavior, it goes away. If you see a 5 or 6 year old doing this, it's hard to break that habit at 5 or 6, because now it's a learned behavior. But if you get this going on at 2, you can fix this very quickly, very, very quickly. And many parents will say, my baby was such a good baby, he was so easygoing and sweet, and now he's having these temper tantrums all the time, I don't understand it. So now you know what to explain. Okay, the 2-month-old can walk up and down stairs, they climb, they take off their clothes, they're constantly removing their shoes, they're constantly taking off their gloves, it's 20 below zero, and their little fingers have frostbite, but they will not keep gloves on. They can build a higher tower 6 blocks, turning doorknobs. We already talked about sphincter control. What kind of toys do you want to give this child? This child now needs things where he can manipulate the environment. He's totally into the environment and he wants to manipulate it. Whether that means building something, or that means putting his hand into some sand, or putting his hand into water, pouring cups of water, putting sand in a pail. They are totally into manipulating their environment. Give them toys, finger paints. When a 2-year-old paints a picture with finger paints, I guarantee you he could care less what you do with it. He doesn't even care what it looks like. What he's interested in doing is sticking his hand in the paint. And all he really wants to do with finger paints is feel the paint on his hand and see what happens when he takes his hand and mushes it around on the paper. He'd be just as happy to take his hand of paint and smear it around on the wall. He doesn't care about making a picture. Parents care about that. So then they take this masterpiece and they bring it home and they hang it on the refrigerator. And they say, Johnny, look at this beautiful picture. I'm going to show it to your daddy. And Johnny says, that thing? I thought that was garbage. But okay, if you want to show it to my father. So the father comes home and the mother says, look what Johnny made in nursery school today. And the father says, oh my God, that's wonderful. And so then the child says, oh my God, these people are really crazy. First they give me lollipops when I kick and scream, and now they're telling me that this thing that I thought was going in the garbage is a masterpiece. So then the child, how they learn, oh mommy, put this on the refrigerator, hang this up. Okay, but in the beginning, they could care less what they make. They're not interested in the finished product. They want to just feel what the material feels like on their hands, and that's what they want to do. So anything like that is good. Water play, finger paints, crayons, as long as they're non-toxic, some of the stuff. If you give a 2-year-old, 2, 2.5-year-old crayons, he'll scribble like this. He'll just keep going like this. Will he ever make a picture? Never. If you say, Johnny, what's that? He'll say, I don't know. It's my mommy. Oh, it's my mom. And then, they go by the reaction they get from the parent. So they're not stupid. Okay, so that's what you do with toys. So you want to give toys that stimulate the child's ability to manipulate his environment. Okay, pick something where he can manipulate the environment. By 3 years old, he's pretty agreeable. He's more into the yes thing. Most 3-year-olds will answer any question with yes. You can say, Johnny, do you want to have peas for dinner tonight? Will you eat some peas? Yes. And you bring a plate of peas. And what does he say? Peas? I don't want peas. Well, you said yes, because they say yes to everything. By 3, they usually are sharing. They understand the concept of sharing. They sometimes start to have nightmares by the time they're 3 years old, which can be very frustrating and scary. They start to become fearful of things like monsters. And so one of the things that you can do to help them overcome these fears is reassure the child that there are no monsters. You say to the child, don't worry, I'm going to get that monster out of your room. What you're really telling the child is there is a monster in the room, and you believe also that there's a monster. So that reinforces to the child that a monster really exists. So what you want to tell a child who tells you he's afraid of monsters is there are no monsters. You can leave the light on when you're sleeping at night so you can see that there are no monsters. You have to reassure them that there are no monsters. Lots of people like it when their child is afraid of monsters because they can use it against them. and they say, if you go in that room, a monster is going to come and get you. And I guarantee you, no three-year-old would go anywhere near whatever it is you tell them a monster is hiding in. And that's not really a psychologically good thing to do, but people do do it. The best way to alleviate the child's fear is to reassure them constantly that there are no monsters. Monsters don't exist. Three-year-olds understand, they know their first and last name. They can usually repeat their name. They understand sex differences, but they don't really completely understand what the sex difference is all about. So, for example, if you say to a three-year-old, do you know the difference between a boy and a girl? They'll tell you yes. But if you ask them what that difference is, they'll tell you girls have long hair. Girls wear dresses. Okay? Girls are mommies. They won't really tell you anything more than that. Three-year-olds can run. They can dress and undress. Basically, their skills have really improved. They can ride a bicycle, a tricycle. They can pedal. And now you really want to give them things that stimulate imagination. You're really focusing more on toys stimulating imagination. Between 3 and 5, they're really into imaginary things. They like to play dress up. They like to play pretend. They like to play house. They like puppet shows. They like puzzles. They like stories. They like videos. 3 to 5 year old is more into playing games that involve imagination. Okay, so pick something where the imagination is involved. They like to color. Okay, they like to make pictures. Now they're into that because it's imagination. I'm making a picture of a pretty house. I'm making a picture of, whatever. It's imagination. Okay, issues related to hospitalization of the toddler basically have to do with the separation issue and the loss of control. Here you have a child who is starting to finally have some control over his life, all right, and you take all that control away from him. So he's going to rebel, and he's going to start to cry and scream when he doesn't get what he wants. So one of the things, besides offering the caregiver, and we talked about that already, loss of control, when you have a child or even an adult who's feeling very out of control, give them some control back. Give them appropriate choices and set limits. So, for example, you can say to a two-year-old, it's time to take your medicine. Do you want to drink milk or juice afterwards? Okay? You've given the child control. He's allowed to make a decision, an appropriate decision. He's not allowed to make a decision if, do you want to take medicine? What do you think any two-year-old is going to say if you say, do you want to? Right, they're going to say no. So if you say to a child, do you want to drink milk or juice? The medicine isn't even the issue anymore. Now he's thinking about, well, do I want milk? Do I want juice? Do I want milk? The medicine is almost a non-issue. So this is how you do it. And I do this all the time. It works like a charm. I do it with adults too. They don't even know. It works really, really, really well. I do it even if I have to give a shot. Sometimes when I have to give an injection to a child, maybe 3, 4 years old, not so much a two-year-old, but a 3 or 4 year old, I say, you're going to have a shot now. Do you want to use this needle or this needle? Or do you want me to use this needle or this needle? And I show them a regular needle, like a 1-inch needle that I was planning on using. And then I show them a 3-inch spinal needle. And I say, you pick the needle. And guess what? Of course they choose the needle that I was going to choose. And psychologically, it gives them such a sense of control that they almost completely comply with the procedure. As opposed to, I'm giving you a shot, lay down, be quiet. That's a very scary thing to have happen. And you know what? Even with adults, it works. It really does. If you have an adult who's very apprehensive about a procedure, give them some choice in the matter. Okay? So this is a way you can do it. Do you want to sit on your mommy's lap or do you want to lay on the table? If you have to hold the child still, you say positive things to the child, like, we're going to give you a shot now, and we are going to help you hold still. Not we're going to hold you down. We're going to hold you down is very threatening. We're going to help you hold still gives the child control. Oh, I'm going to be in control of holding still. I'm just getting a little help. I don't care if you're sitting on that kid. You tell him that you're helping him hold still. Okay? It works beautifully. Believe me. I'm telling you stuff that you can use, besides for the test. You can use a lot of these things in your practice, and you're going to see how well they're going to work. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is, when you're going to be examining or doing procedures with the child in this age range, toddlers, do not approach the child directly. You come in the room, allow the child an opportunity to check you out first. Don't even make eye contact. Don't walk over and say, "Hi, Johnny, how are you today?" because he's going to run away. You walk in the room, talk to the mother. If the mother's not there, talk to the teddy bear. Okay? Let the child come and look at you. Okay, before you look at him. That allows the child an opportunity to overcome some of his fear of you. You're not so threatening if he can look at you before you look at him. Don't make direct eye contact with a child of this age group. Talk to one of their toys. Ask them a question about their toy. What's your bear's name? Okay. How does your bear feel today? And use sort of a diversion in order to get the child's attention. There used to be an old question on the exam. It may come up occasionally. I haven't heard, nobody's mentioned it recently, but there was an old question on the exam that said you had to do a blood pressure on a four-year-old, and the child was hiding under the table. What should the nurse do? Come back later, pull the child out and take his blood pressure, tell the child he has to come out now because you need to take his blood pressure, or sit and wait for him to cooperate. The answer was sit and wait. Mm-hmm. The thing with the boards is, if you remember when you're answering questions, don't read into the question. Don't say to yourself, "Oh, well, I might have 7 other patients, and I don't know, I might be running the unit, I could be in charge today, who's going to have time to sit and wait for this kid?" Just answer the question they're asking, if it was the ultimate perfect situation, because that's what they want to know, unless they're telling you it's not the perfect situation. So if they tell you this kid is doing whatever, do whatever's best for the patient. Don't do what's best for the nursing staff. Do what's best for the individual patient at the time that they're asking you about that patient. Okay? Forget about everything else. They just want to know, do you know what's best for the patient? Okay, the other last thing I want to talk about with this age group is where it says regressive behavior. What happens is when children or adults are under stress, they tend to regress in their behavior, particularly when they're sick. Everybody knows this, because for the women who are here, when your husbands get sick, what do? They lay in bed and, "Honey, can you make me some tea?" Okay? All right? I guarantee you, even the biggest CEOs of the biggest companies, when they get sick, "Honey, I don't feel so good today. Can you bring me some aspirin?" Okay, that's what people do when they don't feel good. And women do it too. Don't worry, guys. "Oh, I have a headache. Oh, I can't handle it." Okay, everybody does this.
Please move to the next section of the lecture series.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and leave a rating. We wish you all the best in the coming examination. See you next time.